And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here!
Welcome to Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, here in Phoenix, Arizona. Hello. Good morning. Good morning. Waking up. You know, it's one thing better for me is that, everybody else changes daylight savings except Arizona. We're always Greenwich Mean Time minus 7 hours. I mean, that's the only thing I know to do that has any stability. We are the same time everybody else changes, okay? So that means 9 to noon, you know, is 6 to 9 for me here, West Coast. And then it moves 7 to 10. I get an extra hour. Yay! Okay, so we're in the, early time. Now, today we're going to be spending the last 2 hours with Davi Barker. We had him on last week talking about his pilgrimage to Mecca. Now, here's MuslimsForLiberty.org, Muslim Agorist. There's so many more questions about his actual trek. He filled up 2 journals, just in his, it was like a week and a half or 2 week trek that they did. Because Mecca is not the actual destination. You start there, then you go up into the mountains, and it's just like the free market will provide. I'm sorry, you need a banjo? Well, we got that right here. Okay, answer's always yes, just how much. So we're going to go ahead and finish that conversation. There was a lot to talk about there. Now, for the first hour, we're on with John Holmquist. I'm going to make sure I got that right. We'll check. And the web pages, we'll just give them out right away. Everybody get ready. Get ready. You ready? Get ready? Ready? Coinable.com. Coin, A-B-U-L. C-O-I-N-A-B-U-L. Coinable.com. Bitcoinstore.com. Bitcoinfriday.com. And today is Bitcoin Friday. We're going to find out what that is about. John Holmquist, head of marketing at Coinable, has been involved with Bitcoins for almost 2 years, where they focus on Bitcoin business. John aims to make the highly technical Bitcoin easily understood by anyone. Well, he'd be the first. Okay. John is involved with Coinable, a gold for Bitcoin merchant, with the site We Use Coins, the best website for people new to Bitcoin, as well as recently launched website BitcoinStore.com, which is selling electronics for prices lower than both Amazon and Newegg. Oh, sucking them in. Okay. John recently founded the site Bitcoin Friday after seeing a lack of merchant sales in Bitcoin, as well as a lack of organization between Bitcoin vendors. All right. Now, this is what we've been doing. And then there's some links, and you go to today's archive, and Donna has all of the goodies right there. Now, this is my first question. If Bitcoin is secure, it's semi-easy to use. You can get your wallet on your smartphone. You can transfer. You go blip, blip, blip with QR codes. You can get them. You can send them. You can do them. We have it up on Freedom's Phoenix. You go to subscribe to the magazine, to the e-zine, and there it is. I can pay in Bitcoin. Bring it on, bring it on, bring it on. Now, the thing is that we needed to close the loop. I wanted, with BitInstant, I have the ability to go get a number, transfer, wire, go to the bank, say, put this much money in there, credit me Bitcoins, boom, it's credited. I can go to a merchant. You hear that in the advertisements, Liberty coin precious metals here in Scottsdale, they will take Bitcoins. I go there, boom, Bitcoin, I get silver. All right? Silver obviously goes into cash, so I close the loop. It's all good. Now, the reason that it is in a wave, a massive, oh my goodness, everybody and their grandmother, and it's on option via PayPal or Amazon and eBay and everybody else to do it is, I don't know. That's what John's going to tell us all about. John, I got you there.
Hi.
Okay. Go ahead and get up to the microphone.
Hello.
There you go. Okay. Now tell me everything. Now, you first became aware of Bitcoin, you know, when, and then how long did it take for you to understand the future and embrace it?
I believe I was first introduced to Bitcoin about 2 years ago. I just heard about it through a couple news stories. I didn't actually think anything of it when I first saw it. It really took a couple of another couple of news stories before I started paying attention to it. I still don't think I totally understand it, but it probably took me a couple months to actually grasp a lot of the ideals that it puts forth.
Which is what? I mean, what enticed you to go further? You go, okay, I'm starting to see something. I need to know more about something. So what was it?
Well, initially I was really interested in how Bitcoin applied to poker networks because of Black Friday, where all the poker sites got shut down by the U.S. government for basically laundering money out of the country into poker sites. Bitcoin is totally decentralized, exists outside the banking network, so it could be used by poker sites to allow cash in, cash out extremely easily.
Well, the man doesn't want that. Okay, so,
no.
Well, why? I mean, why is that such a bit? Why are they trying to get control of all pipelines going in and out of the monetary system? I mean, what is really going on? What's your suspicion?
Really, I think the initial issue with the poker sites was basically money laundering. But the interesting thing about Bitcoin is that because it's an open blockchain, an open ledger, which means that all transactions that occur on the blockchain are publicly available to view. Government could hypothetically track money laundering a lot easier with Bitcoin than certain things like cash.
I don't see, but how would they attest to its ownership? I mean, that's one thing about Bitcoin that's very interesting, is that it's like grains of sand on the beach. You know, I mean, you may get access and possession of them because you got the algorithm or the password or whatever to control a fistful of sand. But, you know, it's still out there in the chain and you have access. It's yours. But how do they know who has it unless they know who has the password?
The private key. The only way to figure that out is, as you said before, the entry points in or out of the system. So basically where Bitcoin gets exchanged for cash or whatever equivalent.
Okay, well, I was interested in closing the loop. You know, BitInstant helped with that. Yes, we can, you know, go from cash into Bitcoin and Bitcoin in the merchants into cash into whatever. You know, I see it. Okay, you can do it. But if you're just trading Bitcoins, well, you know, I met some people at Libertopia. The gentleman had a lot. I mean, he got a lot early on, and now it's like, you know, worth a lot more. So he's talking to Stephen Kinsella, the intellectual property guy, and the discussion was, how do I maintain property ownership rights in something that, one, the government sure as hell isn't going to protect it. You know, they're going, hell no, you're on your own. You're doing this. You don't want us in your face. Well, we're not going to be in your face, and good luck to you. And he goes, well, I have control, and I got the password, and these are mine. What if somebody takes them? Can I go, hey, man, that guy took my stuff? Or is the intellectual property rights we don't recognize, and it's all about how much you can control and keep your password secret? So, we got to take these things seriously, and merchants got to understand. And that's one thing, is that if a merchant does not understand exactly how this works, or that the math can't be broken by the new latest supercomputer or something, they got to have some kind of understanding, or at least somebody has enough understanding to ensure the transaction. Where's the insurance company?
Quantum Vibe. It's year 2523. There are colonies on Venus, Mars, and Mercury. People travel in bubbles, fly at hyperspeed, with brain implants and artificial gravity. A scientific genius and his clever assistant set out on an adventure through the solar system on a secret mission to find the key to access new frontiers and save liberty. QuantumVibe.com from Big Head Press.
Rhodes, it's the Ernest Hancock Show. Where we're going, there aren't any roads.
Or likely any fiat money. You know, there'd be, you know, it used to be that money was a receipt for what you had in somebody's bank. Okay? If it's Wells Fargo money. You got script there, that little chest that was on the back of the stagecoach either had gold or silver in it, you know, most likely gold, so they didn't have to, you know, haul around as much. It was either gold or it was some kind of script. And you'll see all the paper goes up in the stagecoach, you know, raid and everything, but that wasn't, what kind of money was that? It kind of looked funny. What is it? It was a bank receipt. It belonged to an individual bank. Other banks may recognize another bank's whatever or think it's not counterfeit or work, but usually it was a, you know, the same bank, you know, that was, you know, had branches around, whatever. You know, you get the paper, it's just kind of, it's paper. You know, so I can see in the future that there's going to be, we want to take our credit and, you know, whip it around. In fact, on the front page of Freedom's Phoenix today, I hadn't even looked at it. It's a picture of a credit card. And it says, this is why nobody will use credit cards in the future. And I'm going, okay, well, it looks like a credit card. It's a little computer, you know? So, I mean, your card, it's a little computer with buttons on it and displays and stuff. So, I mean, we'll look at that. You know, it's an LCD screen into its, you know, the card itself. And you got a little computer doing transfer and whatever. Well, sounds like a Bitcoin thing. Now, you're just like your credit card could have, the thousands, if not tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars of balance. You get yourself a little Black American Express and you're buying countries. So I'm going, okay, can I do the same thing, you know, with a Bitcoin card? Well, maybe. But the thing is, who do you go to and say, hey, man, somebody stole my card, you know, give me another one, fraud. You lose that card. You know, it's like you might as well just take your $10,000 you had in your wallet and, you know, leave it on the subway or something. So this is, you know, you got to look at Bitcoin differently. You know, you got access to your smartphone and open with an easy password or whatever next, and you get the, you know, Bitcoin's all mine now. So I'm, you know, these are the basic questions. You want to have a merchant involvement in this. You want to have somebody accumulating them and using them and trading them as a currency and storing of, oh my goodness, even wealth, you know, which I'd rather do with, you know, silver and metal. But, you know, I go across the border, I travel, I'd just rather have a, you know, a piece of paper with a long password and encrypt whatever the heck I got, the private key that's tattooed under my hair, back of my scalp. You know, it's like a treasure map on the internet. So these are real things that we need to start, you know, thinking about. Now, John, we're talking to John. Now, John Holmquist is with Coinable.
Correct.
Coinable.com, you know, BitcoinStore.com, BitcoinFriday.com. Bitcoin Friday is, let me think, today, okay? Mm-hmm. So now let's go ahead and talk about the use and security and ability to have confidence for, like, you know, it's always grandma, you know, because I always hear this. I'm 51. I tell you, I talk to you guys all and they go, okay, well, get on. You go, okay, you just is 14 keystrokes. There is no just button. Well, you just, I go, no, my finger is hovering above the keyboard. Which one do I push? Where do I click my mouse? Don't even start with me, you know? So, has it gotten to that point yet?
It is nowhere near that point. We're just beginning to build the infrastructure required for anyone to use Bitcoin. As you said, if you lose your Bitcoin wallet, if you lose your little card containing all your Bitcoin, it's gone. I think before the average person can really use Bitcoin, there has to be some sort of PayPal for Bitcoin, some sort of central site that will secure your wallet and provide access to it, and almost provide insurance for it as well.
You know, insurance is, I didn't even think of that until I'm so smart. I was thinking, you know, I'm going, what government agency, would the people feel more comfortable about the whatever and everything? And I always found that private insurance always worked better than government. And because their incentive is to, not have a problem. They don't want to create a problem for themselves. I mean, they got to be there, the problem solvers, or people don't pay them. I mean, it's that they don't get their cut. So for them to provide this service, they have to, I guarantee, they got the whiz bang, I understand it, advising head SOB in charge is going, yes, we're going to insure this because they have confidence in whatever. So I'm going, okay. So a private insurance company looking at Bitcoin is going, all right, I am confident in the security of the fundamental base backbone of the system due to the encryption or whatever the algorithm, de la, whatever it is. Tell me about that. What is it that they would be evaluating to have an opinion on?
I think that a private insurance company looking at any Bitcoin company would essentially just figure out how secure the Bitcoin wallet is. For a Bitcoin merchant to run their own Bitcoin server.
No. Before we even get to that point, I mean the actual blockchain itself.
Oh, you mean the essentials of security? If any group, I don't know how they would, but if they managed to break the encryption that protects the Bitcoin network, nothing on the internet would be safe. Nothing. No internet banking data. It would all be broken into.
How does that have anything to do with Bitcoin? My question is this. I have if I look at anything, it's going to be a bunch of ones and zeros. I guarantee it. Ones and zeros, mm-hmm. ones and zeros. There's going to be characters. There's going to be encryption. There's going to be this portion of the blockchain is mine because I got the private key to this section here and it belongs. And as I understand it, I got, a book full of characters. And then a few characters or a half a page or a portion of a sentence or whatever is mine and it has whatever value. Okay. So that one, to get access and control that sentence and, the property is mine because I have the private key that can access that and move around and give the private key and now it's somebody else's wallet. So I go, that actual program, that software, that structure, that chain in and of itself is totally dependent on someone else's ability to not be able to take it and it's mine now. That is math. I guarantee it.
Right.
It comes down to math. So I'm going, All right. So how long into the future is that going to be secure without the quantum whiz-bang supercomputer de-la data brain that can just take, okay, it's mine now? I mean, the confidence has to be in the foundational basic blockchain itself, and I need to know who knows how secure that is.
If the Bitcoin dev team ever thought that the encryption software that's being used in the Bitcoin protocol right now was getting close to being compromised, they could always up it.
Okay, so there is the ability to, take the whole blockchain and double the characters.
Right. I don't know what the exact technical requirements would be to do that, but it is very possible.
Okay, so we need to be start from the foundation. I mean, the foundation is, it's got to be, foundation. Because it's like looking at fiat money, the dollars. What's it based on? What's the foundation? Nothing, Okay, well, that's compromised in another way. Let's go ahead and keep talking about it. I think we're going to learn something. And BitcoinFriday.com is today.
It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock. To be a part of the show, call 602-264-2800.
Okay. Berkeley has twice now inserted an LCD screen into its paper magazine to show video ads. Now, this same type of medium and, you know, capacity and get thin and have a display and LCD doing kind of on a credit card. Well, it's a credit card size card. It's a MasterCard. Now, it's a new credit card from MasterCard, reported by the BBC, is going through some, you know, growing pains. The card first rolling out in Singapore before the rest of the world sees it. Has a built-in grayscale LCD screen and a number pad. MasterCard will mostly use these features for security purposes at first, though eventually they plan to roll out bonuses like loyalty rewards and coupons and all kind of interactivity with your freaking credit card itself in real time, looking at it, advertising they go by. You just walk by this store, they got your shoes. I mean, you know, I say we're Minority Report, man. This is going to start getting stupid. So I'm going, all right. Well, we can do Bitcoin this way. You know, we can sit here and go, all right, let's assume now we asked a question. We brought it up. How secure is the actual chain? Okay. The process. Oh, we can add more encryption. They can double it. They can keep going. Big supercomputer come in. We add more. All right, so let's assume that. Now, the interaction, you know, with it, how do I access it? How do I retrieve it? There's some number somewhere, someplace. We've already had stories of people going, oh, they were stolen from me. Yeah, how? Well, I left my smartphone in the couch and somebody found it and took it. Okay, I mean, you know, okay, well, you know, is that a problem with the blockchain or, you know, you're careless? So let's get to that point now. We're on with John Holmquist from Coinable.com. Now, first tell me, what is Coinable, what does it do, and why do I care?
Coinable is a Bitcoin to gold merchant. That means we sell gold for Bitcoin. The nice thing about that is because Bitcoin has no chargeback fraud, because there's no central authority to go complain to when you want your money back, it allows us to cut out a majority of the fees that we would normally pay if we use conventional payment processing.
Okay, so how and why would you want to do that? You go, you know what? You give me enough Bitcoins, I want Bitcoins more than I want gold. Okay, or I get some kind of, what's the fee that I'm paying to you to do that? And how do you get, you know, where are you going to get the fee that gives you the value of the Bitcoin compared to gold or to U.S. dollars? And what are you comparing it to? You know, are you comparing it to U.S. dollars or euro? Or are you, making the transfer and what the value is in grams of gold? I mean, how are you doing the transaction?
We're actually just shipping out physical gold to people's addresses. We're more of a cash out location for Bitcoin than anything else. We're not really big believers of storing immense amounts of wealth in Bitcoin, because right now it is really very... It fluctuates a lot.
It's a currency more than it is a money.
Yeah, I think it's more of a bank wire 2.0. It's outside of the banking system, and it's a lot cheaper and more efficient than a bank wire will ever be.
Okay, so how much are you taking in a transaction to cash out in the gold?
We've had transactions up to about $30,000, I think.
I mean, how much is your cut?
Our cut? Very low. It's about the same cut as a cash-based transaction.
Wow. So you have, you know who the insurance company is? It's you.
How so?
If I do Bitcoin and you give me gold, I'm pretty assured and insured that it's worth some gold.
Right.
You know what the insurance is on my Bitcoin? Is I can get gold for it. That's my insurance. Okay. Now, so we're talking, now that's an investment in, endorsement of the actual Bitcoin. If somebody's willing to give me gold for my Bitcoin, guess what? My Bitcoin's worth some gold. So so how much in transactions have you done?
We have, we just reported our first year of figures, and it was over $1.5 million.
Oh, the man so wants your ass, okay? Because this is the loop right here that they, hell no. that if you can take anything and convert it directly to gold without tracking, without information, without get to know thy neighbor, without, retinal scan, de la hood, they want you to be their new best friend. Okay? They got a place for you. So I'm going, so what's your threat from the man? You feel any threat, any letters, any concern?
We're just another merchant accepting payment. We have to provide as much information as the government requires to protect against money laundering. But other than that, it's really no different than accepting payment in PayPal or
so. What's that limit? If I do 1,000, I'm good. If I do 5,000, I'm not. I mean, where are we at?
I'm not sure of the specific laws. I don't handle that side of the business. The founder, Jay Shore of Coinable, does.
Okay, so let's go ahead and walk this through the process. I go to Coinable.com, which I have up here. Let's go ahead and do that. I go to Coinable.com, and I say, all right, let's go ahead and find out what we're looking at. Coinable, here we go. Turns Bitcoin into gold. Ooh, or silver. And you have the whole, looks like, any place. All right, it costs this much. Each one of these are this much. And, where do you get your feed that gives you the value of Bitcoin? How do you determine that?
We mainly use Mt. Gox, which is the leading Bitcoin exchange. So we get our Bitcoin price or spot directly from them. And then we use an aggregate of gold spots to determine gold prices.
Okay, so you're still using kind of the dollar as a base, right?
More or less, yeah. Just because we have to pay off all our suppliers in dollars as well.
Yeah. Now, sooner or later, it's going to be renminbi or, grams of gold or based on silver or something. I mean, it could be anything. It's like, where you get your feed, So, all right. So I get it. Now, the thing that is of interest to me is I need some kind of assurance, insurance, or whatever that I'm getting. Okay, you're getting Maple Leafs, you're getting Krugerrands, you're getting Eagles, you're getting whatever you have available up here. So I feel pretty confident. Okay, this is like real gold, and you're pretty confident that okay, it's like a real Bitcoin. And I'm going, what's the transaction time? What's the difference? And what if you don't supply? Who do I go complain to? I mean, how does this work?
We are a legal corporation, so if we don't supply your product or defraud you, you can open up a lawsuit against us or go through any of the legal channels to get your money back.
Okay, so what's its turnaround time here? I go on right now, I give you some whatever denomination of my Bitcoins to get me some gold, and I say, here, send me. You got a shipping cost, you got a handling fee, you got a, whatever. Tell me how the process works. I go do it right now.
The process right now is taking anywhere from 1 to 2 weeks, mainly because we're in the middle of scaling. We're aiming to get it at under 48 processing hours. That's the ending goal.
Okay, so scaling, what do you mean?
We're making the business bigger because of all the volume that we've been going through.
And where are you guys located? Do you have a physical location?
We're located in San Diego. We don't have a physical brick-and-mortar store yet, though.
I mean, do you need one? Do you want one?
That's also a good question. I think it would help support the local community and maybe get another couple Bitcoin merchants in the area to convert as well.
Yeah, but why would you want to be in California? I mean, that you're just begging for trouble. They said, yeah, we got the marijuana co-ops. Now we're going after the Bitcoin co-op. You know what I mean?
There actually hasn't been much government interference with Bitcoin yet. And
yeah.
The Bitcoin Foundation recently launched as well.
Okay, now that's the next thing that we want to do. You can see very quickly once it started maturing, here we go. All right, yeah. I like this. It works. Yes, I got places I can spend it. I can convert it to silver here and gold here in Scottsdale, or I can go through Coinable and do gold right there online. The loop is closed. Oh, let's go get a brick and mortar so the government has a place to go visit. Do we want this? Let's talk about it.
Before I became a customer of Liberty Coin and Precious Metals, I called one of the internet companies that sells gold. I didn't like the impersonal hard sell or the fact they were in another state. Liberty's different. I could walk in their store, look them in the eye, see, feel, and walk out with what I'd bought. No hidden fees, no hard sell, no mystery, just great prices. And Liberty's one of the biggest gold sellers in the Southwest. Their experts took the time to get to know me and my investment needs. There's so many reasons I'm now a Liberty Coin and Precious Metals customer, but the most important is I trust Liberty. Remember, they're right here in Scottsdale. So drop in or call Liberty Coin and Precious Metals, 877-888-8052. That's 877-888-8052. Or on the web at libertycpm.com. Liberty.
Freedom is the answer. What's the question?
I want to break free.
You're listening to Ernest Hancock.
I want to break free.
Okay. Let me bring this up. Give you a scenario. We went through this, okay? Eric Voorhees from Ben Instant, and that, these guys have been helping us out, going through it, and John Holmquist is taking advantage of this opportunity to promote what they do and having Bitcoin Friday. And you go to different, but it's Bitcoin time, okay? We need to understand this. We got to be on the leading edge of this. Go to BitcoinFriday.com. Share around a little bit of Bitcoin. Go play, okay? We need you to. This is the, still beta, but it's a freaking Zeta working, all right? So that, we get through this, and we start seeing how when people are actually giving you gold for Bitcoin, damn, okay? I mean, if that was the test, if I'm looking for a test, yeah, blah, 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 what can I get with it? Gold. Oh, okay. Problem solved. Next. What's the next question? Well, I don't know. That pretty much answers a whole bunch of them, okay? So that is your insurance assurance, is that I go in an endorsement of the Bitcoin. Somebody's going to give me gold for it. Not doilies. Not the homebrew beer. Not, which has value, worth gold in some instances. But I'm just going, gold, done. Done. That's what they're doing at Coinable. Coinable.com. Now, John Holmquist is, this is the question I have for you, John.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to... I go to the bank, I transfer a couple hundred dollars, the same day, a couple hours, whatever, I'm credited my Bitcoins. I go to, you heard the commercial for Liberty, they out there, they were willing to give this a shot. They got a couple different merchants and ways that they can do it. Now, what they do though is how do they or you keep track of the inventory and the transfer of the money to pay the man taxes? If you're a brick and mortar, certainly, or if you're doing inventory in and out, either you're not reporting and you're just outside the system, or you are. And if you are, how do you report? I got X amount of Bitcoins that change in value and so on. And when do you report it to the government on your, if you even do? So what their thing was, they said, this is what we'll do. We will take the transaction and immediately we cash out. We go, okay, it's worth this much, and we just cash it out through someone like whoever, and they take the cash as if it was a cash transaction. So it doesn't get reported as a Bitcoin transaction, because there's no Bitcoin transaction box. So what they do is they go, okay, we take the Bitcoin, it converts into cash, we report the cash like it was a cash sale. Oh, well, what if it was over X amount of thousands of dollars? Did you do your get to know your, rich friend form or something? Okay. So these are all things that, if they're not here with you guys yet, they will be. So I'm going, okay, so you get the Bitcoin. Do you keep that or do you transfer it into cash and report that or do you even want to share?
We do cash out and I believe that's how we report it.
Okay.
I don't do the taxes though, so.
All right.
You'd have to ask Jay.
Okay. So this is what everybody has to deal with as a merchant, because think about it, I'm playing this merchant thing, when and how am I reporting this? And this is one of the problems of government that you even got to ask these questions. Think about it. You just want to backhand government. Okay. But you got to keep this in mind, especially if you're going to go to a brick and mortar. So the advantages of going to a physical location in Southern California, no less, is what?
What do you mean?
No, why would you do it?
Go and pay with Bitcoin at a physical location?
No, why would you open a physical location?
Oh, mainly just because that's where we're basing all of our operations, mainly because it's where we live. we might move to a different location if it's more convenient, which it probably would be.
You know, so the main thing is you're going to have a place that you have to sit around a desk and do something anyway. Might as well be, you know, commercial. You can go in and people can come spend money, you know. So, all right. So the Bitcoin, we have others listed attributed to you, Bitcoin Store, Bitcoin Friday. Tell us about each of these.
Okay, so Bitcoin Store is a recent site that was launched under Roger Ver, who is a huge Bitcoin advocate. He also runs another site called memorydealers.com. And so this site is, it's basically selling all the electronics and computer parts that Amazon and Newegg sells, and selling them cheaper than Amazon and Newegg sells them for.
Why?
Because of Bitcoin and the lack of fraud, chargeback fraud specifically, he's able to cut 5, sometimes 10% off of the risk and use all that money that he saves to give back to the consumer.
I just can't imagine. Is there any rumbling at all from the government to try and get a handle on this? I mean, you just know they don't like things that work that are outside their control.
No regulation yet. I think when the government does come, they'll come to the Bitcoin Foundation. And I don't see really what issue they have with it, though. It's just it's a more efficient payment processor.
They don't get their cut. That's what they don't like. I mean, let me think for a second. Money. That's what the problem is. So, I mean, it doesn't take, I've been around long enough. I see how this stuff works. But, you know, the inherent use and infrastructure and the way that Bitcoins work is that it's not tied to just the dollar. I mean, it could be in grams of gold. It's in euros. It's in yen. It's in renminbi. It's in whatever language. It doesn't matter. You know, that's what the problem. They're going to have to come up with some kind of competing thing, or they're going to try and get bad PR for you and offer their own blah, blah, blah or something. But, I mean, this is really getting you think it's still in beta. This is very advanced and developed beta. I mean, when you can do all this stuff and Bitcoin Store offering the same merchandise as Amazon and so on for cheaper, man, you're coming to the attention of somebody. So
right.
I'm going, okay, so this is interesting. So Bitcoin Store is just a good example of how I can use Bitcoin right now and buy a lot of stuff that, you know, a lot of people need and do already anyway.
Correct, and save money doing it.
Oh, that's so you go do the BitInstant thing, you put your cash into Bitcoin, you go over to, but they're charging 3.99%. That's one thing I'm going, damn. You know, are there other ways that you can convert cash or coin into Bitcoin that is cheaper?
There are a couple. Mainly it's linking bank accounts to Bitcoin services. That carries about a 1% fee with it. But like I said, the infrastructure still has to be built up before it's usable.
Okay, so in my position, like I have a product, which is where you want to be merchants and get on the Bitcoin Friday, is that you're actually receiving Bitcoins for whatever it is, that service or product that you're selling, and then all of a sudden you got some goodies to go spend, save money over at the Bitcoin Store. So it's an encouraging thing that you might want to be selling your organic eggs. And I'm going, all right, I can see to where this becomes a quick, this is happening much faster. I know young people, you know, was young, and I know, hey, man, come on, man, it's good night, rock and roll. Somebody do it, do this, go. But I'm telling you, this is happening, developing much faster than I've ever seen something like this develop before. This is like an open source. They got some good core thing that people have confidence in that they're willing to give you some gold for it. Then I'm going, oh, wow. And if you're starting to, you're willing to do that, this is going to go very fast. And there's going to be a lot of competition, a lot of PR, good, bad, going. I mean, this is going to hash itself out very quickly. So let's talk about Bitcoin Friday. What's that about?
Bitcoin Friday is basically Bitcoin's Black Friday. I contacted a whole bunch of different merchants. Right now, there are 68 merchants listed on the site, and convinced them to hold massive, massive sales just for accepting Bitcoin. So these are a lot of Bitcoin merchants that were launched within the last 2 years that have been struggling along. And it's basically just a way to both thank all the consumers that are using Bitcoin and provide more press coverage for all these Bitcoin merchants that people don't talk about.
Wow. This is, I'm, you know, I want to stay in touch with this. I want you guys to keep me up on what's going on, because I can see that this is going to come to the attention of, you know, somebody doesn't want you to be successful. I can tell you that. But I don't know how they can stop you. You know, that's one of the things about a robust system like this, is it doesn't have the need or desire for the laying on of hands or a license or a government permit slip or, you know, an occupancy kind of whatever until you open up a retail outlet. You know, so I'm just, I can see where this is going. Are you feeling comfortable about it?
I'm feeling pretty comfortable about it.
Okay. This is, you know, good luck to you. Stay right there. I want to talk to you, but I'm feeling, the spidey senses is, you know, tingling up all over the place. And as a zombie apocalypse comes with a, you know, dollar taking a dump, you know, you're just kind of looking at you going, man, does a free market provide? Maybe it already has. And it's got a head start. Bitcoin. Go check it out. Coinable.com, Bitcoin Store, and Bitcoin Friday.
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence. Me, Ernest Hancock. Oh, we got Davi Barker on. We didn't get near finished because he did went to on the road to Mecca. So he goes on the pilgrimage, the Hajj. Help me out. What is it exactly that you were doing? And it's called, and part of the Islamic faith is to be part of this experience that we're going to, you know, finish you sharing with us. But there's so many other things that I want to talk about. But let's go ahead and start off with that. What was it that you did?
Okay, so the word is Hajj in Arabic, and it's the pilgrimage to Mecca, and it's the fifth pillar of Islam, which just is that any sort of able-bodied person who's financially capable should make a pilgrimage to the Kaaba, which is the black sort of cube in Mecca, during the Hajj month, right? And so there's some rites involved. Like, it's visiting the Kaaba itself is only part of it, and you're emulating both what Abraham did and also what Prophet Muhammad did, emulating Abraham. So
this used to be a, you know, multi-religious Jewish Christian Islamic thing.
Yeah, it was.
And then it wasn't because what?
Politics, man. Between Abraham and Muhammad, it actually became both Christian and Jewish and pagan, and a lot of the Arab pagan tribes used to go. And, you know, the sort of like Abrahamic message of the thing was sort of lost. And so part of Muhammad's mission was returning it to the house, to the worship of the God of Abraham. But in his life, Christians and Jews were also present, and it was sort of a rite amongst all of the people there to make pilgrimage there. And, you know, I don't know when it stopped being permissible, but I know that the Saudis don't allow any non-Muslims into Mecca or Medina. They'll turn you away.
That's not Right. I mean, you know.
No, I don't think it's right.
It would seem that this is a very combining thing. I mean, the God of Abraham. I mean, you know, this goes back to roots of. And I would, you know, if I was Jewish or Christian and they, you know, took the God of Abraham and said, no, it's a Muslim thing, Muhammad, you can't play. I'm going, man, if that in the beginning of a rift right there.
It would be interesting. I don't know when exactly that became the case, but I know that the Saudis, they changed a lot of things about the Arabian Peninsula when they came to power. So it wouldn't surprise me if they were the first person to actually enforce that.
Well, you know, they were put in place. I mean, and their position was in, would they have nuclear weapons or something back then? Of course not. They had the British.
What they had was British arms.
Yeah, they had the British Empire. You know, they said, your head sheik in charge is signing this contract, so the oil's ours now. Thanks for playing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's what went on. You know, this is while you were there, did you see a closed society, or is it starting to open up? You got you know, satellite dishes and stuff, and women driving, or what? I mean, you know, what surprised you about the culture?
Well, I would say that the culture is probably more open than the government. Like, it was interesting. Fashion is really interesting because your traditional Saudi dress is. Women are in all black, and men are in all white, and men wear that kind of red, you know, picnic table-looking thing on their head, and women wear the face mask, right? Like, that's traditional Saudi dress for the last 100 years or so. But your younger generation has this sort of weird hybrid between that and modern sort of Western dress. So, like, they'll wear skinny jeans, and they'll wear blazers, and they'll kind of look like hipsters with gutras. It's funny, actually.
So they're not, you know, so they got their, you know, jeans underneath a white robe or something.
No, they don't wear the white robe anymore. Like, Western dress is taking over the younger generation.
Well, I thought that was, you know, death punishable or something.
No, I don't think so. Maybe there's, I mean, they're hypocrites, so they're going to enforce their dress code on women more than they're going to enforce it on men. But I think that the rules for women are relaxed during Hajj because you have women coming from all these different cultures and all these different countries where the rules are different. So they don't actually enforce that on all of the pilgrims.
So it's an atmosphere of Mardi Gras?
Well, I mean, it's still a modest dress. It's just not Saudi standards.
Mardi Gras.
Okay.
Okay. Well, you know, it's all relative. It's all perspective. I mean, in their mind, ooh, we get to wear a colored scarf. I mean, you know, you don't know. I mean, it has the same impact. You know, that little rebellion coming up. That was one thing that's interesting to me. You know, in every society, you have, you know, various different age groups that you're contending with. You know, with the internet and electronics and so on, I'm wondering, you know, do they even have access to the internet? How much do they have? How much is that the culture shifted, you know, between the tweenies? You got the, you know, the 11 to 14-year-olds or something. Are they being slapped down, you know? Are they expressing themselves? Are you seeing young kids out there being rebellious, wearing whatever and stripes? I mean, you know, can you even tell a difference in the age brackets? Or did you go by any of the schools? I mean, tell me about the culture.
The only time I really got outside of the kind of Hajj areas, we'll say, which are sort of like tourist areas, it's not like the real culture, was I went for a long walk in Medina and got outside the tourist area. And then also my brother-in-law is a student there, and so he lives in Medina, and so he took me outside and we went to like a shopping mall. And, you know, the fashion is different, and there's some sort of social tension about fashion. I didn't see any schools or anything, but, I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, there's definitely internet. Like, all of the hotels had your business centers with internet access, so I was able to check my email and stuff like that.
Well, I mean, was it restricted access to certain sites and stuff, or is it totally...
I didn't hit any walls, no, so, I mean, I could get to Daily Anarchist, so...
Okay, now, this is one thing that I remember. As I remember when I was in high school, it's late 70s and so on, during the 80s and such, that if a Saudi guy was caught with a satellite dish inside his compound with his little harem, whatever, you know, he's guilty of, he must be watching porn or something. Well, he probably was, but, you know.
Well, that's not true anymore. People definitely have satellite television.
So that is, there's no information restrict. Are they getting like, well, I imagine they get Al Jazeera or maybe not. I don't know. You know, Russia Today, they're probably getting bombarded with CNN and Fox and all this other crap. But I'm wondering how open, and once you get a satellite dish,
bypasses
I don't know.
All of that.
Yeah, you're kind of, you know, a satellite dish and a 14-year-old and you're good to go. You know?
Well, when I was there in the 80s, everything that came into the country had to go through the government, and you would get back all your, like, magazines and videotapes back from the government with big areas blacked out that they didn't want you to see. And that's just not possible anymore. Because, I mean, the internet and satellite, it bypasses all of that. So there's definitely, like, media revolution happening. Like, they can't block that stuff.
How do they control? I mean, if they can, they will. If they can control their society, if they can keep the people in line to do whatever the heck it is they want to do, if they can keep if they can keep the women from behind the wheel, you know, they will. So when we come back, and you're more with Davi, and I want to talk also, we want to finish up on, Bitcoin. I know he's, all savvy on that stuff, too. One thing we didn't get to mention, John was telling me, there's a new car. You go wikispeed.com. Wikispeed.com. It was the XPRIZE winner for 100 miles to the gallon. It's $25,000 for the car, $20,000 if you pay in Bitcoin right now, today.
A science fiction comic adventure from Big Head Press. Quantum Vibe. It's year 2523. There are colonies on Venus, Mars, and Mercury. People travel in bubbles, fly at hyperspeed, with brain implants and artificial gravity. A scientific genius and his clever assistant set out on an adventure through the solar system on a secret mission to find the key to access new frontiers and save liberty. Quantum Vibe. There's a robot girl and zany creatures made with genetically engineered features, and corporate villains crave the opportunity to steal a profit from mother's ingenuity. Scientific genius and his clever assistant set out on an adventure through the solar system on a secret mission to find the key to access new frontiers and save liberty. QuantumVibe.com.
To be a part of the show, call 602-264-2800, 602-264-2800, and now, Ernest Hancock.
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock. Oh, and Davi Barker, man, he's had an interesting track he wants to share with us. I would like him to share with us. He's so kind to do so. This is, we're learning about a whole nother culture and an environment that has an enormous impact on our lives here. There's an intertwining supporting of the House of Saud by the Western civilizations, and I wouldn't even say civilization, Western governments. They go, you know what? We got to deal with you. You use our money, and we'll buy your stuff, and you be rich, and keep your people in control. And when they start getting out of control during Arab Spring, they just went back and gave everybody billions of dollars and said, y'all be quiet. Okay? Oh, okay. All right, if that's how it works. And your experience there is, I'm trying to get the interface between American culture and there. And you had a little bit of it, you kind of chameleon. I mean, you got to walk amongst them. You got the right clothes on. You got a beard.
Yeah.
You know,
sure.
So you were able to not stick out too much, you know. So what did you learn?
Well, one of the things I was kind of amazed by was how free the market is. There's a lot of prohibitions, like you can't, like alcohol and drugs are a capital offense, but at the same time...
Explain that.
If you're caught with alcohol or caught with narcotics, it's a capital offense in Saudi Arabia, so it's not a free market.
Okay, well, define capital. Death, dying, destruction immediately on the spot by cop, or what?
Oh, no, there's probably some sort of a trial.
Some sort.
I don't know, I didn't see it, but yeah, there's trials, there's a court system.
I inhaled dead.
Maybe. I didn't see it implemented. I just know that it's not for sale, right? But at the same time, there's no taxes. There's no income taxes. There's no sales taxes. It didn't look like there were any sort of permits or anything. Like, people would just sort of set out blankets and sell on the street. So you end up with this incredibly bustling market outside of all of the areas that pilgrims are going. Like, all the way out into the desert, you'll find people, like, pushing carts and selling things to you out in the desert. So,
well, let's talk about some of the things that they're selling. I mean, did you have a whole lot of Mylar bagged, cellophane-wrapped American from Walmart kind of stuff, or was it wrapped in a goat skin?
No, it was Mylar bags. It was SIM cards, and it was and most of it was probably made in China. But it was essentially, every little plastic kind of souvenir thing you might want to bring home to a relative as a gift. And then on top of that, it was everything that you might want on this trip that maybe you didn't bring, like bed mats and blankets and pharmaceuticals and stuff like that. So,
what about drugs? I mean, actual pharmaceutical antihistamine eye drops. I mean,
you don't need a prescription. You can buy everything over the counter.
Well, that's, if I'm buying a whole bunch of Oxycontin, I'm not needing some other painkiller. I mean, how do they enforce this drug thing?
You know, I think it's completely arbitrary, probably.
Okay. And what's the backbone of everything as far as the government infrastructure? Are there, recognizable law enforcers?
There's Saudi police that wander around everywhere. So as far as I could tell, there's two classes of police. There's your guys in your sort of brown shirts, I guess three classes. There's guys in these sort of brown uniforms that, wander around and kind of just harass people. And then their immediate superiors are people who are in the traditional Saudi dress with the white robe and the red rap, and they're, I think, some kind of scholar or something, I don't know, but they have like a badge, and the brown cops refer to them when it's a religious issue. And then you have your military guys that are wandering around in fatigues.
Carrying?
And it looked like just a sidearm. I didn't see any rifles.
Okay, so there was no, you didn't get the feeling of a military presence, we're here to keep the peace with a gun at your forehead.
No, actually, the domestic police are unarmed, as far as I know. They're really anti firearm in Saudi Arabia. So, other than the military, I don't think anybody carries a firearm.
So, do they carry knives? Or they got the big giant Lawrence of Arabia daggers, or what?
No, nothing. They're just they carry their arbitrary authority. I think it's a society that runs on harassment. Like, if you deviate from the norm, whether it's illegal or not, somebody is going to harass you. And if it's not a police officer, it'll be a citizen. So,
a male or female or both?
No, women harass men too. Yeah, I think that's probably what keeps the society running, is a sort of everybody's harassing everybody else. There's a lot of yelling and a lot of pushing. That's the biggest cultural shock for me was how much everybody is sort of, prying into everybody else's business.
Really? Well, like, define that. I mean, how you're walking down the street, and what would bring the attention of somebody?
All right, so I'll give you an example. When you go to the Kaaba, really any mosque, as this happened for me, I started getting really bad blisters. And so what I did was, because you're supposed to take your shoes off when you enter a mosque, right? But the mosques there are all marble floors, and it's awful to have blisters walking on marble floors. So I bought a special set of sandals to wear only in the mosque, and that's allowed because it's clean, right? But every 10 steps, somebody is, like, tapping me on the shoulder and pointing at my feet and being like, you have to take off your shoes. And I'm like, no, I don't. And so you have, like, now you have a language barrier, because this person doesn't speak English. They're just enforcing what they think is the standard protocol, and they're wrong. Right. So that's one example. I mean,
are they trying to be friendly, or are they doing this, church lady, nose in the air thing, or what?
No, it starts friendly, but once you refuse, then they start getting kind of pushy and they start getting kind of upset with you.
All right. Well, did you see any violence at all?
Violence at all? No, other than crowds pushing, I didn't see any kind of violence. I did see, the police do manhandle people. So that's the closest thing to violence that, that you'll get. Like, there's some areas of these buildings that are, like, it's preferred to pray in particular areas. And so people will crowd around those areas. And so the police will sort of wander around and, like, grab people who they think have been there for too long and drag them out by their shirt. but no fights. I didn't see any fights. I didn't see any, like, real shouting matches. It's kind of funny, like, for talking about traffic. There's no traffic laws. People cut each other off. It's just crowded, right? And if you break whatever the sort of traffic customary laws are about whose turn it is, people will shake their fist and they'll yell at you and it turns into a shouting match. But every time anybody actually hit anybody else, everybody gets out and it's laughing and it's funny and everybody acts like it's not a big deal.
Well, I mean, you know, they not clubbing them with a bat, you know, hopefully, but and little things like the trash pickup. I mean, if you're doing all this Mylar water bottle time, man, there's a whole bunch.
Oh, it's tons of trash. It's tons of trash.
I mean, they just throw it under. We're going to talk about that, too. You know, how they are courteous to their hosts. Do they pick up after themselves or not? Who does? Are there porta potties? I mean, and what logo's on them?
There are those that just want to be left alone. And those that just won't leave them alone. Which one are you? The Ernest Hancock Show.
It ain't so groovy when you're screaming in the night. Let me out of this cheap B-movie. Headlong down the highway. And you're rushing headlong out of control. And you think you're so strong. But there ain't no stopping. And you can't stop rocking. And there's nothing you can do about it.
You know, one thing that you can do to have an impact on the world is to be a part of it. You know, go around there's nothing you can do about all the stuff that the government's controlling at a higher level and what they say and can't and the infiltration of culture with. And a lot of people around the world, especially governments, are very, very anti the West. And what does that mean? Are they anti the West government? Well, I don't know. They're, you know, freaking holding hands, walking around president and prime minister and sheik and head and king of and all their all in a line and get the group picture with a smile, you know, or is it something else? Is there an infiltration? Well, you know, Davy Barker goes to Saudi Arabia and spends a long time. How long were you there?
A couple weeks.
So a couple of weeks, you're getting kind of, I don't know if you're immersed, but you definitely got a dose. So I'm going, okay. So as
you know, I was doing my grocery shop there, so.
Well, how's English there? Is there a lot of English speaking or like, no?
Well, all the signs are in Arabic and English, so it's easy to get around. I would say none of the sort of, I wouldn't say English is very common, but the sort of like the higher class you get, the more common the English becomes. So you're not going to be able to speak English with a street merchant, but once you get into your upper level shopping malls, it seems like a lot of people speak English.
Well, is it's taught in school as a, you know, as a demographic age thing, as, you know, the younger people start to come more into the market over the last 10 years, all of a sudden you got every 23-year-old speaks a little English, or is it a generational thing, or is it a class thing?
It's probably a class thing, if I just had to guess. I don't know what the education is like there, but there's definitely kind of a class structure. It's kind of racist, actually. Like, Arabs are kind of like top notch or whatever, and then your working class is all African and Pakistani immigrants that are sort of like treated like an underclass. So there's a lot of sort of like light on dark racism going on.
Well, does the immigrants from Africa or Sri Lanka or the Philippines or, you know, whatever. I mean, are they the requirement that they're Muslim?
Yeah, probably. Oh, well, absolutely. Yeah, if it's in Mecca and Medina, it would be.
Okay, so you have, they're bringing it. So, you know what? We need some slaves. We need some workers. We need some, you know, them.
It's probably
separate.
More like indentured servitude. You probably sign some kind of contract that says, like, if you want to be in this city, you have to work for this company for this amount of time.
So they're doing it. They're still looked down on them. You know, because we need day laborers, semi-legal immigrant, day law worker, indentured servant, whatever, but they're Muslim at a different class level.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, I haven't gotten to the bottom of this, but the company that does it, and it's got to be some kind of weird, like, state corporate partnership, but anybody who's cleaning a mosque or anybody who's sweeping a street, like you talked about garbage, they're all working for a company called the Saudi Bin Laden Group.
Of course.
So that was sort of interesting to see this on everybody's shirt. Like, you could not get away with that in the States.
Well, the Bin Laden family were...
Oh, it's huge, yeah.
Yeah, they're this big, giant construction company or something. I mean, you know, they... A big company of somebody's... Knows somebody's, you know, uncle, you know, inside the House of Saud or whatever. Mm-hmm. So they're very influential big boys. So they're looking for Bin Laden. All they had to do is go to one of the 15 gazillion weddings or something. Okay. So this is interesting. Tell us about the trash. I mean, was there a lot? Did they have dumpsters or what?
It was insane. I was joking that I was going to title my travel log Visit Islam's Holiest Sites and Trash Them, because it's trash in the street. It's trash in the mosque. It's trash in the desert. It's people. There's sort of an attempt to put out garbage cans every couple, you know, maybe twice per block in the city. And there's people on staff all day, every day going around sweeping. But it's just piles of garbage. And it's not just your bags and your water bottles. It's like there's these robes that people wear when they're on the pilgrimage, the white robes. And when you're finished with the pilgrimage, you take off the robes, you put on your standard clothes, and you shave your head. And so people just took these robes and threw them in the street, and then they just took their razors and threw them in the street. So at that point, at that day, the street is littered with clothing and razor blades. It's just, it was shocking. It was offensive to me almost how much people just trashed the city.
You know, I remember one of the things, I talked to John Perkins, you know, the...
Economic Hitman.
Yeah, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. And I've had him on quite a few times. We've become friends. And we had long conversations about Saudi Arabia. And one thing that he said is that they were trying to give Western, indebt them so that, you know, Western companies make a bunch of money and they borrow. And that's how our oil got under their sand. They owe it to pay off all the crap that we did for them. And one of the things that they did was trash pickup. The way they had it before, they just threw trash out everywhere, and, you know, you wanted to keep it clean. Well, that's why you had walls of your big, giant, you know, house or whatever inside. You just threw it outside the wall. Well, you go out there, and I go, well, what happened to it? And they go, they had goats. Goats eat everything.
You want to see that book was on people's tongues. Like, if you want to talk about the failure of censorship, that book is popular in Saudi Arabia. And to some extent, walking around the city is a testament to that book, because you see cranes constructing things everywhere. And I think if the government had any say in it, that book would be burned in their country. But there were more than one person asked me if I had read that book.
Really?
Yeah.
So this is, he wrote another book, a sequel called Hoodwinked, and I, you know, didn't get into that one as much. The Confessions of Economic Hitman was, it simply goes like this. They go up and they say, we installed you and recognized you as the leader of this geographical lines we just drew by map makers in France and Britain. And you're the head, got the whitest robe, and you're tall. Okay. So you're the head guy in charge of whatever, and sign the contract. And if you don't sign the contract, oh, well, you know, we got a plan for you. Well, then here comes in the CIA assassination. If they don't play, well, here comes the freaking military, and we get aircraft carriers, we win. So, I mean, it gets that bad, and that's what's going on with Iran. You know, Iran, they had their Shah guy in there. He's a scumbag, but he was our scumbag. And then when he goes away, we go, no, we need our own scumbag again. They're trying to do it with Syria right now. So this kind of stuff... Do they see what's going on in Syria as just another, you know, the fulfillment of this economic hitman story?
You know, I didn't talk to anybody about Syria, but I know that the Syrian people I know in the States absolutely see it that way.
This is, it's amazing what, you know, they've been able to get away with this because they're insulated. They, them, those that control the aircraft carriers, you know, you don't know who they are, or you think you know who they are, and it's not them. I mean, you know, it's everybody's just a layer of insulation for them. They're just the insulation on the wire. The real, you know, movement of electrons is going down the metal in the core. And I'm going, this is interesting that you would have that particular book come up. How long has it been published there, or how did they get it, or is it because of the internet? What?
I have no idea. It was one of the first person that brought it up was one of the organizers from the travel agency, because half of the travel agency lives in Saudi and they're Saudi citizens. And so he got in a conversation, he started the conversation with, who are you going to vote for? And I told him that I didn't participate, and he said, that's probably better. And it was really nice to have somebody not kind of come back at me like it's my duty to vote or whatever.
Now, and recognition of, you know, the truth.
Yeah, so he brought it up. Like, for him, it was, like, sneaky. Like, have you ever heard of this book?
We'll talk more about it. I think it's fascinating. We finally have, you know, an agorist, you know, a libertarian, a leave-me-aloneist Muslim, goes to Saudi Arabia, spends a couple weeks, and kind of gets an education. He's sharing with us more with Dobby Barker when we come back.
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock. We have Dobby Barker on that just got back a few weeks ago. Well, just a guy, man. It hadn't even been a couple weeks, you know, from Saudi Arabia, where he did the Hajj. Okay, now this is of interest, you know, to me, the different things that you did while you were there to entertain yourself and education, instruction, everybody. Ooh. You know, you had outside your room, I guess you did this take or give station, just kind of, you know, kind of, we go to different festivals and so on. You're at Pork Fest, you got a list, I need, and who's got, or I have, or you just put a pile out there and people take what they need, leave what they don't want. Kinda, how'd that work out?
It worked out really well in the apartment complex. It didn't work out so well in the tent city. So just to explain the I come from a kind of a festival family. So, you know, I grew up going to Renaissance Fair, and I grew up going to Burning Man, and now kind of Liberty Farm and Pork Fest are my primary festivals. But that's sort of like, when I used to go on a trip, that's what I think about. I'm kind of looking for kind of ways to entertain myself. And so this is sort of one of the things I did, was like I created what's called a take or give station, which means I took like all the stuff that I had that it turned out that I didn't need, and I figured that someone else in the building probably needed it. And so I set out a little like station where people could take the stuff that I didn't need, and they could also either leave stuff that they had or whatever. So,
well, on the ground, on a table, on a park bench, in front of your door, how'd this manifest itself?
There's kind of like a shelf in the staircase. So everyone's on the like second, third, or fourth floor of this apartment complex, and most people took the stairs. And so I just set it up on a kind of shelf inside the staircase.
Well, did you have a sign telling people what it was? Or you touch this, I kill you? I mean, you know what?
No, I made a sign that said, take or give station, and then I said, we all have things that we don't need, and we all need things that we don't have. And just like laid it out there, and I put out a donation box, and I said that I would use the money that was donated to sort of feed the poor locally. And I mean, it was a big success. I mean, I actually got some pretty sweet stuff out of it. So that was popular.
Well, tell me some of the things that you put out and some of the things that people left.
Okay, so I had I put out some like medicines that it turned out that I didn't need because a lot of people got sick and I didn't really get sick. And I put out some books that I wasn't going to need. And I had an extra one of those white garments. And so I put that out because some people lost theirs. And, you know, like extra water and whatever. I mean,
well, what wound up getting put on there? What kind of tray? What did people leave there?
I actually got a backpack because my first backpack that I brought was destroyed. I wrecked it. And so I actually grabbed an extra backpack off of the shelf. And, a lot of people put all kinds of stuff. mostly seemed like toiletries and medicine that people didn't need, or people put out maps because the post office passes out maps of the city, and so people put a stack of those there. I actually put a stack of my silver cards there. Just, you know, whatever you might need, you know.
Okay, now your silver card you're talking about is the dirham and the dinars and all that. And so there's certain, in Islam, a certain level or amount of silver is considered a certain denomination in weight, and it's used in transactions and so on. So your cards were explanatory. They understood what they were, and how popular were they?
They weren't really popular in the market because I feel like people didn't understand what they were. And there was also a language barrier in most of the market. But anybody who I met who was interested in the topic of currency, I gave it to. And then even some people who, I met people who still thought the U.S. dollar was backed by gold, and I had to explain it to them. And once I explained it to them, then they were interested, and they, like, took this thing, and they're like, I'm going to look this up, I'm going to figure this out. So that was cool.
You know, another thing, I remember talking to you before, you had kind of like Shire silver, you were putting strips of silver in there, but you were saying the real silver that was used was Turkish. So had you taken Turkish, you know, 10th-ounce, you know, dime-size Turkish coins and put them in your cards like that, you think it would have had a different impact?
It might have been. I haven't found a source on enough of a quantity of Turkish coins, especially silver coins, because most of them are gold, and, you know, it's a lot. It's an expensive thing to carry around in your wallet. So I'm looking for a good silver coin, but it's hard to find one where I could buy 100 at a time the way you can with silver dimes. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I know. I'm wondering, probably U.S. is not as recognizable. Just like, you know, in France, they're doing the kind of 10th-ounce version of the franc there, and doing their little dime card stuff. I got some samples of that, which is very cool. But
I know the real used to be silver. There used to be a 9-gram silver real coin.
And what happened? They just not anymore.
You know, now they're on their paper standard. So
and you know that's just tied to the dollar. All the heck.
Oh yeah, it's a fixed exchange rate. It's like 3.7 reals to the dollar or something like that. So it's actually backed by the dollar.
Oh, that's not gonna last. Okay, all right. Well, if they understood what you were doing and you got a nice infection into the market there, man, you'd be going to jail for that one.
Maybe. If I ever go back, I'll bring reals.
Yeah, okay. This is, okay. Well, you know, let us know how we can help. That's interesting. Now, you know, when you're doing a lot of this trading and stuff, say, I promise you put in a donation here, I'm going to help feed the poor. Did you feed any poor?
Yeah, I put together 200 meal packs while I was there.
With made up of what?
Well, the staples are dates and nuts, and then I put in some like fruit juice and some chocolate just to sort of, you know, make it a little better.
And then these are what, like baggies, Ziplocs, or brown paper?
Yeah, I just did Ziploc bags. It's they cost me a couple of dollars, or probably somewhere around a couple of dollars per bag. I don't know the exchange rate exactly, but yeah, and I just kept them in a bag, and whenever I saw beggars, I gave them food instead of money. You know, the beggars, I don't know if you've seen Slumdog Millionaire.
Yeah.
But that's the kind of beggars that you have there. You have these people who were kidnapped as children and had their, like, limbs amputated to make them better beggars. So if you give them money, they're just gonna bring that money to whoever has enslaved them, and so I'm not going to give them money.
Okay, so you have... And that happens there too in that society. They'll just get some random, you know, bunch of kids, lop off a leg and throw them on the corner and say, you know, I get whatever.
Yeah, because it's extreme poverty outside of the tourist areas. There's extreme poverty in that country.
Wow, why? I mean, you know, you would think with all the oil and so on, they'd, you know, keep the natives not restless or something.
Well, part of it is that they're not Saudis; they're Africans. I mean, they're Saudi, they live in Saudi, but they're not members of the larger Saud family. And most of the sort of social programs or whatever go to directly to members of the Saud family. So, like your upper level stuff is just pure corporate crony capitalism, where it's essentially like there aren't enough government offices for all of the Saudi princes, and so those Saudi princes who don't have government offices are given sweetheart deals for their corporate projects. And so, yeah, you have an extreme disparity of wealth in the country because all the oil goes into one family. It's a monopoly, right? It's a cartel. It's not even a government. It's an oil cartel. And so, yeah, everyone else is in extreme poverty. They don't even do their part to, like, maintain roads and sidewalks and things. So,
how is this society, how does it function? By force, threat, intimidation, compliance of more than enough is on one side? Because there is some dissent, you know. In fact, you know, Bin Laden represented a lot of that dissent. You know, yeah. There was, oh, man, we got, oh, it did not good. So I'm...
Well, I mean, if you go all the way back to before an American intervention, you have essentially, you have two Bedouin tribes, the Rashids and the Saud territory. They're essentially just fighting over dirt because the country doesn't really produce anything. And the Rashids appealed to the Ottomans for help, and the Saud's appealed to the British for help, and the British won. And so, I mean, that's how they came to power. But yeah, it's a closed society. I mean, no.
Well, you know, when we get back, I tell you what I want to focus on. When we come back, you know, your experience is there, and we'll get to, you know, when you came back, some things. But my main thing is that how sustainable is a society like this? How long will it last? How much influence is on, you know, the culture from the youth that are starting to get exposed to other ideas and information? I mean, this is fascinating. You know, when was the last time we had somebody that, one, spoke good English, you know, that was Islamic, that went on a pilgrimage, that understands voluntarism, that been around, us? I'm going, wow, this is a very unique opportunity, why I wanted to continue this conversation with Davi Barker into the next hour. You guys stay right there.
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here!
That you're unafeared, go to Saudi Arabia and spend a couple of weeks. You know, Davi Barker, you know, we have him on telling us about his trip. Now, you know Davi probably from a lot of other things that he does. He's a marketing agent for the Silver Circle movie. He does a lot of stuff there. You know, he's a propagandist for Vote for Nobody campaign. So he's asked, you know, while he's on his trip in Saudi Arabia, who are you voting for? And he's like, nobody's going to stop the wars. Nobody's going to fix education. Nobody cares about it, but nobody. So guess who he's voting for? Okay, nobody.
The latest one is nobody wins whether you vote for him or not.
Oh, that's a whole theme that we'll see what happens over the next election cycle. You also author for the Daily Anarchist, the San Francisco Muslim Examiner, National Libertarian Exam. You do a lot of write. How many articles a week do you write?
At least one a day. I'm aiming. I used to aim for one a day, but you know, since I've been laid off, now it's at least one a day. I could probably bump it up to two or three a day because it's gonna become kind of part of my income now. So.
Oh, you got laid off? Tell me about that.
Yeah. Well, I guess so. I was working as a graphic designer for a screen printer, and when I got back, they essentially said, well, you were gone for 2 weeks and we got by just fine, so we don't really need you to come back.
Wow. Well, you know, okay.
I'm not torn up about it. People, you know, this is California, so everyone's first reaction is you should sue them. But I'm just, I've been wanting to get off of the W-2 for a while, and I've been wanting to, you know, like, live what I say. I want to be a full-time agorist. I want to find ways to be a freelancer, and so I don't see it as a bad thing at all.
All right, cool. So you've got an opportunity to do some other stuff. Now, you have a unique position in being in the Muslim agorist. I wouldn't imagine you have a lot of competition.
Nobody. I've met two other people that have used that name.
Really?
That, yeah. One of them's in Australia, and another one's just a woman I found on Twitter. I'm not sure where she's from.
Okay. Well, like I said, not a lot of competition.
But there's plenty of Muslim libertarians. So I mean, there's Muslims for Liberty. There's Minaret of Freedom. So that's not that unusual. I think there was actually a libertarian candidate for Senate this time around that was Muslim. But
you're not talking about Obama?
No, I'm talking about Obama. I like to say, if Obama's Muslim, I want to excommunicate him.
Oh, you know, that was another thing. You know, did people think of Obama as around the world? Did they kind of tout that? I mean, they used to really push this Kenyan thing until they didn't, you know? So I'm just wondering, you know, is he seen as Muslim friendly or as a closet Muslim? Or with a name like, you know, Barack Obama, you kind of, you know, Hussein Obama. I mean, you know, hell, they ought to just, you know, revel in that.
I didn't get the impression anybody thought that he was Muslim. I did have, like, a random guy from Nigeria come up to me and tell me how important it was to vote for Obama. But the best reason he could give me was that the United States hadn't done anything to Nigeria. So,
this week, just wait. All right, Africa's on the list. All right, now, in your travel over there, there's a lot of things that you brought with you. You brought with you, you know, just a whole different philosophy and experience here. And you go there and you see 10 cents a gallon gasoline. Are they rationing? I mean, is it available? Are they worried about gas mileage? I mean, you know, how does that impact their society?
It's subsidized, right? It's not that the actual market price of gasoline is 10 cents. And so anytime you subsidize something, you're going to cause unintended consequences. And the unintended consequence of artificially lowering the price of gasoline is incredible pollution. You're going to end up with sprawling cities. You're going to end up with no carpooling, no interest in alternative energy, no interest in environmentalism, because it's just so cheap. So that's what you've got. You've got a city that's jammed up, and every street in the whole city is bumper-to-bumper traffic, and nobody's carpooling because, you know, like, there's no point. So you've got everybody's running their cars. Like, you could be sitting in a parking lot, and a person will leave their engine running because they're running the air conditioner. So the pollution is terrible. There's no stars. I saw like 3 stars the whole trip, even in the desert. So
Wait. You're out in the middle of the Saudi Arabian Peninsula in the middle of the desert. I guess, and you're not seeing any stars?
No stars.
You know, the one thing I remember about Lawrence of Arabia that really had an impact, I mean, it's a great epic. I mean, it's a big, I suggest you get a little history in there, too. But the one thing that I remember about Lawrence of Arabia, he was asked by one of the British officers or something, and he goes, what is it about the desert that you love so much? What? He goes, I love it because it's clean.
I was reading a biography of Muhammad's life on my way there, and it was saying that in Muhammad's time, they sent their children out into the desert to be taught by the Bedouins, and it's because the Bedouins understood language and the Bedouins understood freedom. And that's what it says in this biography of the Prophet. It says you send your children to learn from the Bedouin because they understand freedom. And one of the things it said was they need clean air for the breast, right? And they need freedom for the soul. And I was like, neither of these things are here anymore. So it just, for me, it was tragic to think that what was sort of the big kind of cultural value now doesn't exist in the Arabian Peninsula.
Well, do they understand that? I mean, do they see the irony? Or they, you know, make fun of it? Or their T-shirts? I mean, you know, that's another thing. Is there any kind of a self-expression in, you know, your little wristband or your, you know, kind of hat you wear, or you got a T-shirt that says something, or is that frowned upon?
I didn't see anything like that. I did see a lot of graffiti, and so I photographed a lot of the graffiti that I saw, but I need to have someone translate it.
Oh, so you don't know what any of it said?
Yeah.
No, that'd be interesting. You know, I'd share that. You know, and one thing I remember off air, we were talking about this concept of no innovation in the religion and how that transcended their culture. Explain that.
Okay, so in Islam, there's a prohibition of religious innovation, and the idea is that the religion should be preserved as it was originally practiced, and it's fairly well documented, and some people say that Muhammad's life is the most well documented life in human history because there's encyclopedias of accounts of people who knew him, but the Wahhabi ideology takes that to an nth degree, and they exaggerate it from what it's traditionally meant to mean, and they say that the innovation is essentially like the greatest sin in the world, and it's called a bid'ah in Arabic. So anytime anything changes, like, for example, people use prayer beads, right? Like, they're essentially the same as Catholic rosaries, and they say their prayers using these beads. Well, the Saudis have historically prohibited these beads, and their argument is that the Prophet didn't use beads, the Prophet counted on his fingers, and so you should count on your fingers. And so they yell at people for having prayer beads. And like, this is a level of extremism that is new. It's foreign to the history of Islam.
Because you gotta divide and conquer, and they get subsidized. That's why, you know, you got extreme. You know, there's a government somewhere giving them a couple of dollars to have a website, make sure they get so we can divide you up and do and pit against. And it serves their interest. You know, overlapping. No. No Jews, no Christians, going to what used to be God of Abraham Trent.
To be a part of the show, call 602-264-2800, 602-264-2800, and now, Ernest Hancock.
Who grew up tall and proud in the shadow of the mushroom cloud? This now voices can be heard.
You know, how about truth, justice, and I don't know what used to be the American way. You know, let's talk about that. You know, the American way, how's that seen by people around the world? We're talking to Davi Barker, you know, a Muslim for liberty.com. So we got MuslimAgorist.com is a site that we're on right now taking a look at. Now, Davi, let's go ahead and let's talk about that a little bit. And some of the other sites, let's see, we got... vote for nobody. Oh yeah, the Daily Anarchist. You know, Muslims for Liberty. This is a kind of a focus of your life here, and I'm wondering, when you go to another country as part of a religious thing, and you're immersed in this culture, I'm wondering, how did they see you as an American, or how do they perceive American culture? Are you invading? Are they like, glad you're there? They want to ask you a gazillion questions? I mean, tell me how that interface happened.
I didn't get any sort of... I was not flying the American flag when I went. When people asked me where I was from, I said I was from California. I didn't say I was from the United States, because that's just not part of my identity. But... you know, people, when I was in the British district, people sort of joked that the British don't like Americans. But I didn't get any sort of negative repercussions. I met some Afghans, I met some Iraqis, and I was kind of awkward. I was like, what am I supposed to say to these people, you know? But,
death to America! No?
Well, I mean, like, well, I don't know what you can say. I mean, they assume because you're Muslim that you don't support these things, so you don't have to apologize per se, but, I don't know what to say, like, because it's not in my power to stop, you know?
Did anything come up about foreign policy or droning or bombing? I mean, did politics just stay out of it, or what?
People didn't really talk about it. Maybe they were just focused on other things or something. I'm not sure.
Well, tell
me
about.
I was more interested in talking to locals about their country, like talking to them about like how their. I mean, I know how the Sauds came to power, but I was curious to see how common the knowledge was.
Well, what'd they say?
They know their history. They're. I mean, one of the interesting things, and this is like, I don't know what to say about it exactly, but in a democracy, you know, you only have to care about politics for one day, and so people don't generally spend a lot of time talking and thinking about it unless they're like you and me. There, people sit around and they drink tea and they talk about politics, even though they have no control over it. It's like the gossip of the day, right? It's like that's the soap opera of their lives. So everybody's well informed and everybody knows their history.
You know, my thing has been governments only exist for as long as the people allow it. And part of that is the legitimacy that they have. Once their legitimacy is in question, once that's done, once they have none, then any opposition to them is either tolerated, encouraged, or ignored, and there's no, you know, we must come together to save Washington. I mean, it's like, Washington, D.C. is under threat from, I mean, where do I send my check? I mean, you know, I don't know what they expect from us, that we're going to go save them from something. And they do that. America is under threat, you know, our interest overseas, and I'm going, look, man, I don't, that's not on my give a crap list. And I would think that people in Saudi Arabia, if they have an understanding of the entwining of their government or whatever you want to call it with the United States, that they're kind of separate from that. I mean, they're not endorsing it. They're not out, saluting Pledge of Allegiance to the Saudi family every day, or are they? Is that part of their?
No, they're not. Nobody pretends the Saudi government is legitimate. I actually was kind of shocked. I didn't anticipate the kind of, like, dictator posters like you see in most, like, you know, you see in, like, communist countries, but there absolutely are. There's big banners of the king looking like an angel, like, all over the country. And I was like, I didn't think anybody played this game. I thought everybody knew this guy was a hypocrite, but apparently they're still trying to play that game.
And how does that go over the people? I mean, they're going.
People don't buy it. The people know that the king is corrupt.
Well, I mean, they got graffiti all over all the posters, or what?
Well, they're all high up. That's the thing. They're not at the ground level.
Okay.
And that's deliberate. So
yeah, no, I can see. Okay, so the youth there, you have them. You know, you can kind of see a little more technically savvy. They're selling the SIM cards so your phones work. They got, yeah, you know, like probably memory cards or keys or whatever for you. Download your pictures on your camera. They probably got, you need a cable to be able to, you know, interface with the blah, 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 battery chargers. You know, I mean, this kind of thing. I mean, so they a lot of smartphones you saw?
Yeah, everyone's got a phone. They sell them in the market. Most people bought little cheap Nokia phones because the battery life is so long. Like old, like green screen, like, you know, the original kind of Nokias.
Yeah.
And
the other thing we were talking about is, you say it's kind of open to tourism there. I'm interested in, you know, what kind of ghost town it becomes after this one. And this event, it's a 1-2 week, month long. I mean, what kind of sustainability, how long is this event?
It's really only a couple of weeks. I mean, the Hajj month is a month long, and some people arrive earlier and leave later, but the actual rites all take place within, like, a four-day period.
Okay, so you're a week peak there somewhere.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, you know, what, they bring out the bulldozers to clean up the mess, or what?
Yeah, I saw big street sweepers. I saw people with I saw a tractor. Is it a tractor?
A herd of goats.
What is it? No, the goats were brought in by rural people. There were people who slaughtered their own goats.
But, no, I thought they would get them to eat the trash or something. But, you know,
no, but they bring in construction equipment to push the garbage around, definitely.
Wow. So during that, so they just shut down for a while?
Yeah, they shut down. After everybody goes home, the whole city kind of shuts down for about a month. They don't take any more travel visas, and they spend the whole time cleaning up the place.
Wow. Do you see, you know, scars from the previous year? I mean, is it, you know, you get kind of the impression that the bulldozers are hitting the corners of the buildings or something?
Well, I mean, outside of the areas that are, like, built by the state, the city's run down. Like, sidewalks are cracked and roads are broken and buildings have, yeah, it's a disheveled city.
Did you go to any other cities where you saw more wealth? You know, like United Arab Emirates, where you got the, you know, we're, you know, like South Korea now is going to build a, God, it was something stupid, like $500-700 billion resort city to rival Macau or something. Kind of, we're going to be woohoo and show off all our money. Is there a show off money thing in Saudi Arabia somewhere you got to see?
Well, the mosques are the show of money. I mean, frankly, I think that's kind of propaganda for the state, because every time they build an expansion on one of these mosques, they name it after the king that ordered it. So, yeah, you have a disheveled city, and then you step over like a gateway, and suddenly everything's marble floors and gold filigree and all this stuff. So, I mean, that's where the money goes, or at least some of it, and I think that has to do with their attempt to appear legitimate.
Okay, so when we come back, another thing, you know, daily life. Did you get to experience any of that? Well, you know, I want to find out, you know, how they live their daily life. We get the children up to go to what school? Any school? Do the girls get to go to school? Did you see any small people underneath the veils? I don't know. We're going to find out daily life.
Roads? It's the Ernest Hancock Show. Where we're going, there aren't any roads.
Muslim, and you go to Saudi Arabia, you definitely going against the wind, know what I mean? So, you know, head down, leaning into the hurricane was Davy Barker. Now, Davy Barker, he's got MuslimAgorist.com, and he's got the 7 Stones for Advocates. You know, he's telling about his story. You know, this is a very interesting story, and I encourage you, we haven't even got into a lot of the stuff in his kind of internal awakening, you know, his epiphanies that he had, you know, a lot of the interesting things that he's come to realize about himself, the religion, the people. It's like, go to Muslim Agorist and get that. What he's sharing with us is, you know, he's answering, you know, my questions. I'm very curious about a lot of the different things, and he mentioned as we're going at the end of the last segment, he's talking about, well, you know, I kind of gave up on the fast food thing. I went to the grocery store. It's really crap. Woo, woo, woo. Time out. Back up. There's fast food there. Is it, you know, like you go to Mexico and on the street, they got a big terrarium with the, you know, goat, you know, falling off the bones and they're peeling, putting on tacos. I mean, you know, what kind of fast food are we talking about?
Well, it's both. There are street vendors that have meat kind of just up on a rotisserie and they just carve it off and put it in a sandwich for you. And then there's also McDonald's and Burger King and KFC and all these sorts of things. And then there's everything kind of, there's a kind of mix, right, where there's fast food chains in the area that are modeled off of American fast food, but they're serving Mediterranean or Arabic food.
And you got, you know, how clean are they? Are they got health permit? Is there straw on the floor at the McDonald's line, you know, where you walk your goat in with you? I mean, you know, what are we looking at?
Well, I wasn't interested in getting sick, so I actually didn't eat anything from street vendors. But, you know, the malls look clean, so that's what I went by. I mean, I don't know whether or not they have, in fact, I'm probably fairly certain they don't have kind of FDA regulations. But at the same time, like, the shopping mall, I mean, I trust the market. So if a shopping mall looks clean and serves 4 million people, I kind of trust that they've got something in place to keep things clean and healthy, you know?
Yeah, if they're not outside the door in the fetal position, you know, soiling themselves, I guess they're okay. So, all right. So this is, you had a decent experience. You didn't starve. But, you know, I'm wondering, the one thing I wanted to talk about is that I'm really interested in what happened to the, you know, the romantic view of, you know, Lawrence of Arabia, Arabian Nights, you know, this kind of romanticized version of Arabia, clean out in the desert, the flowing robes and the camels and sitting in a tent breaking bread with and having the belly dancers do. And so where's that? That doesn't exist anymore.
You've got to go to North Africa for that now. This is kind of what I was getting into, was the takeover of Arabia by the Saud family was political on the end of the Saud family, but it was religious on the end of the kind of Wahhabi ideology. And King Abdulaziz ibn Saud allied himself with a guy named Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab, who was this religious fanatic. And they brag that he's from this family of scholars, but if you look, his father and his brother wrote books refuting what he said. So he was a poor student, and he was only came to power by political means. And when his ideology swept the country and when the Sauds took over the country, they kicked all that stuff out. They purified the country of these dangerous religious innovations. And all those people moved to Pakistan or Africa or were killed. So, yeah, I mean, they, you know, they took over by force. That's where that stuff all went.
Okay, great. Let me get this straight in my head. You know, I'm trying to get this. Now, you have two main denominations, I guess, or influential groups. One is the Wahhabi, and the other is what? The Bedouins or something?
Just everybody else. I mean,
everybody
the rest
else?
The thing is, before them, there wasn't, it was not considered the norm to enforce your religious ideology on people. People wrote books and refuted one another, and there was sort of an open discourse about what correct theology should be, and people subscribed to all different schools of thought.
So they didn't have the force of the state with a gun making sure you had to, whatever.
Right. So the Wahhabis came in and they said, no, you're wrong and we're right, and we've got British guns. So this is now the religion of Saudi Arabia. And they uprooted all the cultural stuff. They destroyed a lot of the cultural stuff, like full-blown bulldozed historical monuments. And they've been destroying the history of Arabia since they came to power. Like, a lot of the grave sites of prominent members of the Prophet's family, or a lot of sort of monuments that were created to particular events in history, the Saudis come in and they destroy all of that stuff because they say it's idolatry.
So they want to consolidate power.
Well, they essentially want to destroy history because history's not on their side.
Right. So they consolidate power.
I mean,
they don't want to diversify it into anything else.
1984.
I'm sorry?
It's the memory hole in 1984. You have to destroy the past to control the present.
Okay, so who's in charge now? What is the dominating? So it is what? The Sauds are represented by what? Wahhabi or something else?
Yeah, the Wahhabi ideology is the kind of official school of thought in the country.
Which is what? You know, we rule you? I mean, you know, how would you recognize that over something else?
How would you? Well, part of it is it's intolerant of alternative perspectives. Part of it is it's incredibly paranoid about idolatry in any form. So, like, if you put it, like, their graves don't have names on them because they're worried that people are going to come to their graves and worship people. And, I don't know how to explain it theologically. It's really more political than religious.
So it's Republican, Democrat, and we're in charge, Republican or whatever.
It's like an Inquisition. I mean,
no, it's just who's got the shiny badge at the time, and you challenge us and get on the rack. Got a waterboard for you.
So let's see. Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab was very critical of cultural elements that had become part of Muslim society, but were not specifically religious. And so he declared them all religious innovations and sought to rule them out. So things that had become traditions that were not necessarily directly from the religion, but just sort of cultural, they outlawed. And they said this is actually against the religion. It's not just like, because the steady state in
that which is not required is forbidden.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. I mean, that's the new, and that's the opposite of Islamic law traditionally. Traditionally, everything is permissible until it's specifically forbidden.
Okay. So then, well, tell me about, you know, the tribes, nomadic, the Native Americans. I mean, you know, the Saudi Arabian ships of the desert caravan tent people. Are they just gone?
Well, I mean, they might be in the outskirts of the deserts, but I didn't see them. My experience is that that's all in, those people were all pushed into other countries.
So is the South family increasingly being seen as a plague upon the land kind of thing, or are they embraced? Are they seen as beneficial to the society at all, or are they just in the way, or they're ignored? I mean, what role do they play?
I mean, it's the state, right? You have some people who say you don't need it, and you have other people that say it's a necessary evil.
Is there a group that's looking for another necessary evil?
Yeah, obviously. The other thing is a lot of the Islamic movements throughout the Middle East are called caliphate movements, and it's the idea that there should be kind of like a pope in Islam, right, called a caliph. And that person, if he's ever to come to power, has to be a Mecca, by definition. It would be like if the pope didn't control Rome.
That's a good place to stop right there. When we come back, I want to get into that. Okay, what Excalibur or saber sword or whatever they call those big swords came out of what rock to give them the authority of, and how would somebody replace them if ever? I don't know. Let's talk about it.
Uncovering the secrets and exposing the lies. That's what the readers of FreedomsPhoenix.com get every day. FreedomsPhoenix.com constantly providing the information, the real news about government policies, and the real relationship we all have with the coercive government. The real condition of the economy, innovations in technology, breakthroughs in energy, health, and computer science. Learn the truth well before it's admitted to in the lamestream media. The corporate media, nothing more than distributors of government propaganda, but now there's an alternative. FreedomsPhoenix.com. Constant news updates on the issues that affect your life in the most important ways. With liberty and property under constant attack, FreedomsPhoenix.com provides the understanding behind the propaganda, and it encourages the participation of its readers. Go to FreedomsPhoenix.com. That's Freedoms with an S, Phoenix.com. FreedomsPhoenix.com. The revolution between the years has already happened.
It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Here saying hello, Dobby. She just wants to say, yo, what's up?
What's up?
She's going to be, I don't know what she's doing. She's here on the farm, bring some friends. We're going to, go chill. So, it's good to see you, Alma. I get a big hug here in a second. Okay. Now, the one thing that we left on, and I wanted to make sure we got right back to in the final segment here, is that there is a some kind of sanction laying hands on somebody, something, his robe's whiter, they got more guns, the gold braid's more pure, something that makes, this guy is my leader because, what sword did they pull from, Excalibur from a stone or something, I what do they call those big Arab swords? I can't remember. Starts with an S, I think. I can't remember. Anyway. So, pardon?
A scimitar?
Yeah, a scimitar.
Like swords?
Yeah, a scimitar, right. Okay, now I'm looking at this from our standpoint. What gives them the sanction is not who you voted for, but the fact that you voted. Let's go sanction the government by voting. If you're complaining you voted, you're just a sore loser. Okay, you've been happy if it came out and they said the computer said the guy you want, but I'm just going, no. So that's where this vote for nobody kind of, I'm not sanctioning the process. I'm not sanctioning my rule. Now, if you were to protest in the same kind of way in Saudi Arabia, how would that manifest itself? You start wearing crucifixes around your neck or something? I mean, what?
Well, okay, so traditionally, in Muhammad's life, authority was derived from something called bay'ah, which was an explicit sort of oath or contract between two individuals. So people who wanted Muhammad as a leader came to him and pledged themselves to him, and he claimed no authority to rule or legislate over people who hadn't. So that's a system of explicit consent. That's a voluntary system.
Well, how voluntary was it if, his goal then was to kill him or eliminate him? Or
that's
was he
not
just...
what he did.
Okay,
that's
well,
what people
you...
after him did.
Okay.
That's not what he did. What he did was units of society that had made bay'ah or had pledged themselves to other leaders or were members of other tribes were independent and had to be dealt with at the level of treaty or contract. He had no authority to dictate to them. And so what you had was a polycentric order. You had different groups of independent authority contracting with one another in the same territory. And so that's what I would advocate. That's essentially Stefan Molyneux's DRO model. But that's not the reality today in any country anywhere.
Well, don't go leave me hanging like that. DRO model, what does that mean?
Okay, so Stefan Molyneux's DRO model, dispute resolution organization, and the idea is that the things that you would commonly think of as municipal services could be achieved contractually with competing companies or competing organizations.
Okay, so they kind of their culture, their religion, their the way Muhammad said this is how thou does it, you know, was we have arbitration, we have, you know, but then it gets to wherever you give somebody the authority to judge, do you give somebody to enforce the judgment?
Right, and that would I mean, you would have that in an anarchist system too. You would have people who could enforce contracts.
No, I'm sure you would, but I'm just wanting to know how they do it with a scimitar. I mean, you know what?
I don't know. If you had a contract in that society, it would absolutely be enforced.
And by shunning, by, you know, you take your goats or by something. I mean, you know, somebody's going to justify something, and then it turns in, all of a sudden now you got, you know, a shiny robe you're worshiping. I mean, you know, so I'm just wondering what the legitimacy of the Saud family is based on in an Islamic society.
On an Islamic basis, there is no legitimacy. So what I'm saying is the equivalent of the vote for nobody, if you were in Saudi Arabia and wanted to, like, put it on a T-shirt, you would say something like, no bay'ah, no authority, or something like that, right? Like, no, nobody has pledged themselves to you. You're just a usurper, you know?
I mean, has that actual conversation happened? I mean, is there, you know, you do that in Arabic, a T-shirt, all of a sudden you spark another Arab Spring? And it's all Davi's fault, and you go straight to, you know, they put a whoa-ho, go, you know, kill that guy right freaking now as soon as we found out who put that on a T-shirt. I mean, that's powerful slogans, man.
I'll have to try it. I don't think that they could go after a U.S. citizen without causing an international incident.
No, I mean, they do whatever they want. Yeah, you know, we yeah, okay, right. You mean like Israelis going after Iranian scientists? You mean like that?
Yeah, well, I mean, Saudi is not Israel. I mean, like...
Well, no, my point is that you got Islam going out, you do a cartoon with Muhammad, and your house gets firebombed. I mean, you know, you go doing the challenging of the state with an effective slogan like that at the fundamental root of their legitimacy, people get pissed off to the point that they go, oh, hell no. So your first foray into something like that, I wouldn't be putting my home address on it, you know what I mean?
Maybe. I mean, no, you're talking about different things. When you're talking about outrage over cartoons, you're talking about, like, a groundswell of illiterate, uninformed, sort of rural people. When you're talking about the Saudi government, you're talking about the machinations of the state. It's not the same kind of outrage.
Yeah, no, I don't think... I do not think it would be an outrage of poor Muslims in the streets and placards. I think it's more of a guy wearing jeans and a hoodie and going up, and all of a sudden his paycheck comes from the House of Saud, and he took an airplane flight, and problem solved. So
the Saudis did retaliate against some of the Egyptian bloggers from the Arab Spring. And so some of those guys, when they went on Hajj, the Saudis picked them up and, like, wouldn't let them go, and held them in prison for a while or something. So that was a big controversy for a while, and they eventually, I think, had to release them. But
I rest my case, okay?
So, yeah, that could happen. If I became a big persona of anti-Saudi movement or mission, I could see them targeting me if I tried to travel to the country again.
Well, heck, Osama bin Laden's dead. Maybe, probably. I mean, you don't know. They dumped him in the ocean. You know, so and that was one of his things. He challenged the authority. By what, you know, basis did he do that? Because they put U.S. bases in Holy Land? I mean, you know, when you go and you challenge it, this term that you use, know what? I mean, what was it? It started with a B. What is it?
It's bay'ah, B-A-Y-A-H. It just means pledge. But it's the idea that a leader is consented to. So you could just say consent in English.
You know, no consent of the governed, no consent, no cake.
Sure.
Basically. All right, no consent, no government. No consent. Oh, we're starting to get universal, man. Planetary stuff.
You know, it's sure. a worldwide revolution.
I mean, that's why they're so appealing.
Yeah. You know, that's one, you know, there's a rock band, very popular, like the Beatles kind of version, in Bosnia. And they use the Lovolution logo in their stuff in different languages and so on. And I'm going, wow. You know, somebody sent that to me from Europe. And I'm going, wow. I wonder if there's an equivalent in Islam and certainly in Arabic that is kind of this, you know, well, that's a slogan right there. I mean, you put that on a T-shirt in the right, you know, translation, because we did that in Arab Spring. We sent thousands of DVDs to Alexandria that made it to Egypt. Tiananmen Square, I mean, not Tiananmen, Tahrir Square.
Tahrir Square.
Yeah, same thing. You know, so what we did is we sent all of these in Islamic, not Islam, Arabic translation of the philosophy of liberty. And the translations of founding documents, all, I mean, damn, even on the Constitution page, we had a sticky label that said, we already tried this, maybe you can do better. And I'm telling you,
I know love in Arabic. I just got to figure out how to say revolution in Arabic, and then I can put that logo together.
Yeah, the thing is, man, I'm telling you, you start something like this when it's right. The time is ripe when the people are ready. And you would think in a repressed society kind of like that, where they don't have the legitimacy, and you tie it into that slow. I mean, all of a sudden, you're changing the world. You know, this is the kind of stuff they can't stop, certainly with the internet, which is why they got to try and control the internet. What kind of controls on the internet are they trying to exercise?
I have no idea. You know what occurs to me, though? Movements like that start with the lower class when you have a completely totalitarian society. So you got to start with the Pakistanis and Africans in Saudi Arabia, because the Saudis themselves they're subsidized. They get freebies from the state, so they're not going to protest.
Oh, man. See, an idea as time has come, I mean, it's dangerous. And all it takes is a logo, an incident, a kid, one injustice. We got enough problems here. But these may just happen on their own, which is why we have Haria Phoenix. You go to Haria Phoenix. It's Arabic for Freedom's Phoenix. We translate Freedom's Phoenix into 39 languages. We have our own Arabic Facebook, our own Arabic Twitter for almost 2 years now. And I'm telling you, it's very popular. Why? Because it's everything that he's talking about, we translate into Arabic in real time using Google translators, and it's having an impact.